We're here.
Hello. Of course, if Mario's not the one person watching, then it really doesn't matter that we do that.
Yeah, we could desperately try to get people to pay attention this evening, but we know that there's a huge progressive candidate forum going on this evening. So we're tasked with speaking with a state house representative in the Lone Star State of Texas.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're going to be speaking with Chris Leal. He was supposed to be on our panel, our Texas panel last week, and he got held up at a debate, which is obviously much more important.
Yes.
And so,
I mean, our little show is the, we are the little show.
I feel like we're too far. I feel like we need to move this way. You need to move. Yeah.
I don't know. Who's hair, Mallory? You got to be more specific. I don't know who you're talking about.
She's talking to me.
She's got to be talking to you.
She's talking to me because thank you, Mallory, for being the only person in my entire life that noticed I got my hair colored and cut yesterday.
Good.
Yeah, thank you. And this is even a day after. So thank you for noticing that. My husband doesn't notice. My business partner doesn't notice.
I just noticed.
Nobody did. Whatever. My point is... Oh, male oblivion knows no bounds.
I guess we don't. But we are here this evening in lieu of our traditional Wednesday night show. There is obviously a candidate forum that's going on. We support the progressive candidates that are running on no corporate money.
I would venture to say probably if there's anybody you liked, go check out our interview with them, because most of the people that they're talking with are people that we've probably spoken with as well. So you could get like a one-on-one or whatever. Oh, good God.
Jacob, welcome. Thank you for your support. Really appreciate you being here.
Oh, I do. I do love Vosh. And I get hate for loving Vosh. It's so unfortunate.
I am the walrus.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie.
I am the walrus.
Shut the fuck up. You're out of your element. I was actually just watching just now one of those things where an actor goes through their most iconic roles, and it was John Goodman, and he was just talking about... Yeah, he was just talking about the Coen brothers.
That's probably like the movie that everybody always references.
He can't do that. That's way too.
Well, that's why I said I am the walrus. And so one thing we want to talk about before Chris comes on the show tonight is AOC.
We do?
Okay. Yeah, I think it's important. You know, because there's a couple of things that have been going on. Obviously, a lot of people are very frustrated with her, rightfully so, in lieu of the fact that she gave a politician non-answer regarding whether or not Nancy Pelosi should once again be the speaker of, or in this, well, she wouldn't even be the speaker. It would be, do you want her to be the House Minority Leader after the Democrats get shellacked in the midterms? I understand that it's really a question that, you know, she kind of can't win in regards to her answer, but you have to be willing to take a stand. You do.
Well, maybe she really does like her. And maybe that is what we have a problem with. You know what I mean? Maybe that is her truth. I don't know.
Yeah.
I've not spoken to her. Maybe she truly does like her and wants her to still be the person leading the party.
But to be fair, that's not all AOC has been up to. She's actually been up to quite a bit of good. Number one, of course, is the fact that she more or less is responsible for the vote on banning insider stock trading.
Yeah. How about that?
That's a really big effing deal. And the fact that she is using her political muscle in order to make this a vote by using, you know, some insider tactics, if you will, good, because you're forcing a lot of people's hands. And what's beautiful about that is that we've got a lot of corporate Democrats getting primaried right now. Why don't we add a few more to the list when you find out the ones that are against actually having to take a stand on this? But in reality, I think if they ultimately were to pass a bill that didn't allow for insider trading, you'd see a lot of representatives in both parties retiring. I mean, what the hell is the point of being in Congress if you can't loot the Treasury? I mean, really, what the hell is the point of being there if you can't screw people over, right?
We're going to be talking a lot about screwing people over this evening.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that.
This is the book we are going to be speaking about this evening. It is actually quite good. I recommend the audiobook because there's a certain segment about Jared Kushner that I assure you will crack you up just hearing it audio, whereas reading it might not be as funny. But yeah, it's quite good. Each chapter is a different person that somehow is criminally culpable regarding the coronavirus pandemic. And it's the usual suspects, you know, it's the usual suspects, but it's just very well highlights like each area, like how Betsy DeVos screwed up the schools, how what's Mitch McConnell's wife's name?
Oh,
Chow.
Elaine Chow. Yes.
Screwed up with the transportation, like the, just so many things like that people were just really culpable. And that's what we're going to be talking about. So I thought this was really interesting. And also the general idea that we never hold anybody accountable. Anybody.
No.
Because if we did, the past like four administrations would be guilty of war crimes. Well, so we don't. And that's why it was funny. I was talking to a woman yesterday and she really believes that they're going to successfully prosecute Donald Trump. And it's just not, it doesn't work that way. We don't prosecute former presidents. We just don't.
Not only that.
We just don't.
But, you know, we put out on social media the other day, what would it be uniting, if you will, if both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were brought to justice? Would that be a way to sort of bring the country together? And surprisingly, a lot of people would agree with that.
Wow.
But what you have to remember is they never go down because you have to remain divided. That's really the idea. The idea is our side committed crimes, but your side's worse.
They
That's
don't go
they
down. No. They don't go down because the current administration is not going to go after the previous administration because they don't want the next administration to come after them. So that's why Obama didn't do anything about W's reign of war crime terror. Nope. Didn't prosecute anybody. I mean, Dick Cheney should be
in the Hague.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's like ridiculous. And that whole administration. And then Obama's administration wasn't held accountable by Trump's administration. So this is how it goes, because they don't want to be held accountable for their own stuff.
Correct.
So nobody gets held accountable.
And so now we're faced with the prospect of the continuing spiral. And this again gets back to AOC. And what she did talk about is the fact that Congress is an ish show right now, which it is. Again, the legislative branch is completely broken. And she is also addressing the fact that removing the child tax credit, something so simple, is causing a spike in crime. If anyone thinks that that wouldn't cause a spike in crime, then you clearly have never been piss poor and understand what it means to not really have the ability to, you know, pay for formula, pay for diapers, pay for baby food, who knows what. So if you take that away, I don't know what you expect people to do, but.
Well, look, I know this, that most crimes, and it's something like when we're talking about women that are incarcerated in a women's facility, for example, I want to say it was somewhere between 80 and 90% of the crimes are poverty-based crimes. These are not people that are violent, scary people. These are people, and it's everything from drugs, prostitution, forged checks, things that people do based in that are poverty crimes. And that's the thing that people are not understanding about crime, is it absolutely is connected to poverty, because as a mom, I could tell you there's nothing I wouldn't do to feed my kids. So it is what it is. And so to not see the correlation, there's not necessarily a correlation between poverty and violent crime. That I don't think that's a thing, but definitely crimes of poverty. That's the whole point.
So before we bring in our esteemed guest of the evening, Chris Leal, it is important to note that one thing that AOC has been doing is she has been sticking her neck out, obviously, for Jessica Cisneros and Chris Kassar, I think is how you say his name. And that's great. But when you have that much influence and that much power, you really need to cast a wider net.
Okay.
You need to be able to.
Finish what you're saying, because I have thoughts on this and the Jessica Cisneros thing about AOC with that, because it was during our campaign when we were running, she only made two endorsements, and they were the only endorsements she made for in favor of somebody challenging an incumbent were for the two incumbents that are anti-choice Democrats. That is also why she supports Jessica Cisneros, because Cuellar is an anti-choice Democrat. It isn't because she's really putting her neck out for, like, that's where she draws the line. Apparently that's her line. Corporate whoredom, in and of itself, is not sufficient to support a challenger.
Change. And that's got to change. And again, the one thing that we've been talking about recently, even unfortunately Chris was not here last week, but we will discuss it with him. Texas is not only turning purple in regards to its political dynamic, it's turning progressive blue, which is a huge difference. That in itself really does make a significant change in terms of the overall dynamic. And, you know, as we said last time, the only way that the GOP is going to change their philosophy is if they lose Texas. If that were to happen, they would have no choice. They would have to evolve. Right now,
and then
unfortunately,
there's people like Beto that are just handing them that. Like, you could not pick. I don't understand how you think that can work there.
Well, unfortunately,
coming for your guns. Vote for me in Texas.
But that's not going to work. But that's not going to work. Do me a favor. Can you talk just a little bit, please? It's going to be very important to understand that if we're going to do anything in changing the dynamic, is we need very strong candidates at the grassroots level. We can't be worrying about who's at the top of the ticket, because that's all the Democrats tend to do. We have a lot of great down ballot race candidates that are running without corporate special interest money, which is very important.
Yeah.
And so without further ado, we are very pleased to welcome to the studio for the first time. He is running in Texas House District 114. I hope I got that right.
Well, it's definitely in the Metroplex area, people. It's in Dallas.
I think Dallas.
I know you like Dallas, but it's up in that, you know, I'm a San Antonio girl. So Dallas is just too big and chrome. Like, I think of Dallas and it's just big and shiny and chrome and glass. And then San Antonio is like this little casita and it's all very homey. I don't know. That's just me in Texas.
Well, unfortunately, Chris and I are not going to get along because I'm a New York Giants football fan and you're a Dallas Cowboys fan. And that's definitely strike one. So hopefully we won't find two more strikes.
It has to all be about your sports
games. But sports is life. And if you're a North Texan, of course it's life. So with that said, Chris Leo, welcome to Generational Change.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me.
Hey, so you stood us up last week. You had some sort of big debate, whatever that was, whatever. And I did preface this before with that's clearly more important. I'm just joking with you. But so talk a little bit about your district, your race, like what inspired, I mean, we always ask what's your why, but more so like really what was the final impetus that kind of caused you to get involved in your race? What's going on there?
Sure. And so first off, yes, I am very sorry I missed you guys last week. We've had a lot of little forums in our race, but this was the first actual debate where we could go back and forth. And we were really excited about that. And the consensus seems to be that we crushed it. It seemed to go pretty well. So we're excited about that. So I am in 114. You got that right. Dallas, HD 114. It's a brand new district. And so to sort of answer your questions in reverse, we started our campaign before redistricting. So last August, and look, I like a challenge. So I was coming to unseat a Republican in House District 108. And then we were, you know, 3-4 months into our campaign and redistricting happened and the Republican drew out all these Democratic challengers. You know how that happens. And so they created this new 114, which is a safe blue seat in Dallas to try to shore up some of their, purple districts in the area. But House District 114 is some of the coolest parts of Dallas. It's downtown Dallas and East Dallas, White Rock Lake area. It's a pretty fun area. Deep Ellum, some of these like really historic areas of the city. Dems get 70% of the vote. It's very blue. It's a majority minority district. It's about 55% Texan of color. And it's pretty progressive. When you look at the primary data from last cycle, when you add up sort of just a there's big differences between these candidates, but just as a rough proxy for the progressive appetite, Bernie plus Warren got about half of the primary votes last time. You know, so it's a district that's ready for this type of progressive messaging. You know, we lean into it. You go to our website, it says Progressive Texas Democrat. On all our yard signs, it says Progressive Texas Democrat. On all our handouts, you know, it's like the most obvious thing, you know, because there's still a lot of people, especially in Texas, you know, they're afraid of the P word, but
no, you got to own that.
Yeah, we're out there really, really loud and proud about it.
Needless to say, this is an important race. It was brought to our attention last week that we were not aware of that in Texas state races, there is no cap. So people can donate whatever they want. I can only imagine there has got to be at least one corporate Democratic candidate in this race that you're going up against. I would assume, as we were made aware, based on your endorsements, you do not take corporate special interest money. So what is ultimately going to make the difference for you over the next few weeks as early voting has begun?
Yeah. So early voting started on Monday. So it's been crunch time. Go, go. I was out cold greeting in the rain today. Rained in Dallas. Look, it's a crowded race. We've got 5 people in this race. Anytime you get a safe blue seat with no incumbent, right, it gets some attention. It's me. I'm a middle school teacher now. I have a background in economics before that. But I'm up against 3 lawyers and a political consultant. And so, you know, they've got deep pockets. We have more endorsements than everyone else combined. We're very proud of that. But we are not leading in funding in the same way. So You know,
well, if anybody wants to contribute to what is your website?
Leal for Texas, L-E-A-L, lealfortexas.com/donate. And that'll take you right to our active page.
Guys, spread some love to Texas. You know what I mean? I always thought that, you know, I'm a little jealous because we're Florida. And I always thought that Texas was always going to sort of be like a red suffering place like we have and sort of misery loves company. And now Texas is sort of like kind of, you know, gaining, you know, it's making progress. It's a little bit, unsettling for me. We're losing.
And I heard some of the commentary earlier too, and I put, you know, I have a little unorthodox view on this and that, you know, well, one of the big things that we're pushing for, you know, in our campaign is Texas does have a very prominent progressive legacy that a lot of people aren't aware of. And I don't just mean Democratic, I mean progressive legacy, you know, starting, you know, back in the last Gilded Age and people like Sam Rayburn, who was an architect of the New Deal, you know, FDR gets all the credit, but Sam Rayburn himself handwrote the bill that created the SEC, the FTC, the FCC. And he did these things because he had actually done them in Texas like 10, 20 years earlier sometimes and creating 8-hour workdays for rail workers and stuff like that. And then on to, you know, Lyndon Johnson and Wright Patman. Like, Texas actually had antitrust, you know, laws against monopolies. We were the second state in the nation to have antitrust laws, even before the federal government did. And so, you know, there was really a legacy here that sort of, because for a while, people like Sam Rayburn, he's the longest serving speaker of the House in U.S. history. And so he led the party for half a century. And a lot of this like party of the people stuff, you know, I argue it has a lot of Texas DNA on it, progressive Texas populism, as we call it. And so, you know, and it's been 3 decades. Now we've been in a drought 3 decades since the Democrat has won the statewide race here in Texas. And, you know, we kind of walk around like with our tail between our legs, like we don't belong here. Like, and it's like, no, guys. You know, we do have something here to be proud of. And if we want to make the state politically blue again, you know, electorally blue again, then we need to have a spine and act like it and act like we belong here and that these, you know, prove that these are Texas values, you know, progressive Texas values is what we call them.
Well, you were a resident at the time.
I love Texas. My son was born in Texas. I lived there for 6 years in San Antonio, and I loved it there. So I had nothing but the best experience with Texans and Texas. And I love San Antonio in particular. Now, granted, a lot of that is based on the Mexican food scenarios there because they're really.
I've been there. That's I'm
just saying.
San Antonio was not my jam, but the best Tex-Mex food I've ever.
I love San Antonio, and I am a Spurs fan. And actually, my son's middle name is Avery for Avery Johnson.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, so, I will give you that. Yeah. San Antonio is very, it's a cute place. It's quaint. You know, it's got a lot of charm to it. But, you know, obviously I'm Dallas born and raised. So.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, man, as a basketball fan, 2011, that's the best postseason run I've ever seen.
Yes. I was studying abroad in London at the time with my friend Matt Leck, who is a producer on The Majority Report. And so I was staying up until 2 a.m. finding bars that showed American sports because it was like, the Mavs are in the finals, you know. I got a way to watch these games.
Well, Avery Johnson coached them.
That's true. He did. He unfortunately coached them when the league was very unkind to them in the finals.
Tidbit of trivia.
But we are big fans of Mark Cuban. We appreciate anybody who is in that position of power and influence who does give back and is looking to do the right thing. We need more people in that at that level to recognize just how dire our circumstances are these days. You know, just the fact that, you know, we weren't even aware that there is no financial cap, that you can literally buy state house elections. And of course, I have no doubt that the GOP has a heavy hand in that. But of course, the corporate Democrats are going to play by the same rules. We know that we can't actually change it unless we stand on principle. So with that said, how is the race looking for you at this point? And is it looking like there's going to be an opportunity to potentially pull this off?
Yeah. We're very optimistic. It looks really good. Now it's a 5-way race. And so that means, you know, look, and internally on our team, we're pushing to avoid a run of 50% plus one. So you got 5 people, like I'm a numbers person, you know, I understand that is a likely reality. That's something to be very concerned about, Bill, because as you guys probably know, in these runoff elections are when these things can be stolen and it can come down to who's got the most money because, you know, your own donors are exhausted and your volunteers are tired, right? And you're like lurching to the finish line. And then it's like, if you've got, you know, deep pockets, you just flood the market with mailers and stuff. Like we saw that happen in New York, in Buffalo and stuff. So, you know, we are pushing to avoid it, but you know, it feels, we feel pretty good. We're in a good place. We're getting a lot of good feedback on the ground. Our signs, this has been the most recent source of drama for us. It's, you know, like I said, all our signs very prominently, Progressive Texas Democrat, and had a lot of signs go missing lately or being vandalized or destroyed and putting them out. And, you know, and so, hey, like we're proud to be the, you know, the campaign that the other side.
It's like junior high. It's like junior high school with these people. Yeah. I honestly, it was absurd to me. The what people, it's just, it's disappointing to me that adulthood contains these sorts of shenanigans. I also want to point out, what you don't know is the Texas Constitution is insane. Okay. And when I say that the Texas Constitution is insane, I mean, it's insane. It's larger than any other, it's ginormous. And actually in Texas, the lieutenant governor has actual more authority than the governor.
I've heard that.
And people don't know, Texas is like its whole own place.
Yeah. Well, it's from the 1870 version. They just only, you know, amended it since. Lieutenant governor is more popular. As you guys mentioned earlier, there's no cap on these financial races. And if elected, right, it pays $7,000 a year and they meet every other year. And so it's designed to be, you know, you've got to be independently wealthy or have a very, you know, rich benefactor to support you to kind of have these jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of important things, obviously, that are going on in Texas. You guys recently had that, the abortion bill, which obviously gets a lot of, it's red flagged and controversy, but it is important. And Texas already had very, very dwindling reproductive rights. It was very difficult for women to get abortions in Texas, even as when it's as legal as it can be. And so there's definitely some problems there that need to be addressed by someone that is more of your kind.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really, especially ironic. I don't know. Unfortunate to see the SB8, the abortion ban that came through because, you know, an attack on Roe v. Wade, and Roe v. Wade itself was a Dallas case, came from Dallas. Yeah. And so like, here we are almost 50 years later, sort of just like, hold my beer. Let's see. You know. And that original, I think it was 10 week ban with Roe v. Wade. And, you know, now we're at 6 weeks. And so
it's absurd.
Well, they always say the night is darkest just before the dawn. And that's kind of what's happening right now. The scrounge of, you know, the worst parts of our, you know, politicking and economy are all converging at one time because there is sort of this uprising, if you will, this new generation, generational change, if you will, that is happening. Nice. And, you know, we're going to be fighting an uphill battle for a while. But I think the more we have these conversations, the more we build these cohesive, you know, connections around, you know, not just obviously with what we're dealing with here in Florida, but certainly with, you know, the connections we've made in Texas, which is huge, the Northeast, the West, we've all got to form this non-corporate coalition because there are a lot of people who have been co-opting the word progressive. We see that a lot. But what you can't co-opt is the word non-corporate. So if you are taking corporate special interest money, it's very easy to find out if you are. And so
that's the thing. If you're taking dark PAC money, also that counts. Then you might as well be taking corporate money. We see you.
But that's the change. That is the big change that's happening. And so before you go, I'm really digging your bookshelf. Please share with us a little bit. I'm wondering who that bust is above
your
shoulder.
Who's that bust?
Yeah, who is that?
The bust, not that notable, just a random bust. It looks very nice, though.
Okay, so
this is all Dallas history here, and this is all Texas history. Whole bookshelves of this progressive history and this progressive populism that came out.
Texas is fascinating. I loved so many things about Texas. I did this whole deep dive into Jews in Texas because there's two types of Jews in Texas. There's Texas Jews and Jews in Texas. And they're two different. And I went and did this deep dive on the Texas Jews, and it's fascinating how long they've been there and how like what some of the earliest Jewish settlers in this country went to Texas. I don't know. It's just very interesting to me.
Next time you're in Texas, and I know you're not a big Dallas fan, but come here. We have a Holocaust museum. I live directly next door to it. And it is, I mean, I've been to a number of these types of museums, but this one is very unique in that it localizes everything. It's like, here's what Dallas lawyers were doing at the trials in Nuremberg.
That's
here
really
are the survivors
cool.
that live here in Dallas, and here are their like stories and testimonies. It's like so localized. It's
yeah, crazy. That's really cool. I will remember that.
Do you have, is Dealey Plaza a part of your district? So
yes, it's right. I live, I can, it's a 4-minute walk from my door, and it is in the district, and we had all the weird QAnon people hanging out waiting for JFK to return, you know, a couple of months ago.
Oh, he's coming back all right.
Back to sports games?
No, I'm talking, okay. I said Dealey Plaza.
Oh, okay.
And
yeah, where you know, the assassination happened.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, and it's not that big. It's a very compartmentalized area. And there are people that are still sort of enamored with the whole circumstance, and it brings, you know, obviously it brings QAnon type people, but it brings all different types of people. And
yeah,
so,
the 6-floor museum is right there.
Yeah.
It's a great, great museum.
Yeah. Oh, it is. Absolutely. Texas.
Right, so now I'm going to have to go back to Dallas, because the only time I've really been there was for when I was law clerking at Akin Gump.
When you come, let me know. I give a lot of tours. I know a lot of history of the area. I'll tell you all the spots.
All right, I'll come there.
I'll convert you to Dallas.
Well, you're gonna have to go there, because not only is this wonderful gentleman there, but also Jasmine is there.
Yeah, and, no, we were making some. Well, I have a lot of friends in Texas. I have a lot of judge friends in Texas from law school. Just saying.
Yeah. So there's if Florida can't turn progressive, then obviously Texas is probably the next best thing. I'm sure you'd say that.
There you go.
LeoForTexas.com/donate, guys. Give Chris a helping hand.
Seriously.
No corporate special interest money. And it is a runoff, right? So whoever are the top two goes to the general. Is that how it works in your race?
Well, yeah. So we're still in the primary, but there will very likely be a runoff. And then, but all we have to do is win this primary, because it's a safe blue seat. That's what's so great. If we can beat, you know, the rest of these corporate Democrats, we're going to have a really strong union member, middle school teacher, progressive.
Right. Yeah. No, cool.
Certainly,
very exciting.
Certainly can't go wrong. Chris Leal, we really appreciate you coming on. We hope everything works out. We will definitely be in touch, my friend.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Have a great evening. I really liked his sign. Yes. His sign was really good. I like that.
It's crisp.
Well, yeah. And the way they incorporate the Texas Dallas Star right in the A, you know, I know.
Oh, my God. You always like those little things like that.
Well, of course, because marketing is a key part of politics, as our next guest will tell you, that is definitely something that matters. If you have a good aesthetic, people really like that. It makes you seem more efficient and you know.
Yeah.
Winning.
So, guys, if you weren't on in the beginning, we are going to be speaking in a minute with John Nichols, and we're going to be talking about this book. I read it. Well, I had it read to me. Okay. Cause I now am an audiobook person, you all know, but, it was really good. And I'm not normally the kind of person that digs like, you know, political current event stuff as like, it's just not normally my thing. And I really liked it. I thought it was good. And it was,
it was a really terrible book. I don't care what anyone says. It's totally fake news. Don't listen to what he says. He totally lost.
Your chapter one.
No, I'm totally, well, your I am number one, but number one in everybody's hearts. Believe me when I tell you, don't read the book. It's a terrible book. Don't listen to this guy. It's totally,
I will tell you this, of all the chapters I found that your role to be the least interesting.
No, I'm totally the most interesting man alive, but not when it comes to the dumb things that I do.
Can't with you.
There you go. So John had to get a little trace of that. He is writer at The Nation. He is also a best-selling author. And his new book, which is called Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. And my goodness, there is a laundry list of ones responsible.
As we said, nobody's ever held accountable, ever.
Maybe we could change that. John Nichols, welcome to Generational Change.
It's a great honor to be with both of you. And I prefer you in this persona.
Oh, okay. That's good. I've got a few others, but you know, of course, my Trump had to come out in light of the fact that I'm totally getting destroyed.
The only one of yours that doesn't creep me out is Bernie, because he also does. He also does Clinton, and Clinton gives me the willies.
Well, look, you know, when you're up in the state of Wisconsin, Wisconsin's a great state. It has a progressive socialist history, and we of course have had Harvey Kay on the show, which is a good friend of John's. Hey. And we are glad to have John here today. So we will talk a lot about the history of Wisconsin and how to make it more progressive.
Oh, we're having another cheesehead. Is that what's happening?
I don't know. Are you Milwaukee? Are you Madison? Where in Wisconsin? No,
I am in Madison right now, in my garage. But I am actually from rural Wisconsin. My family is from the southwestern part of the state, which was actually one of the great hotbeds of progressivism 100 years ago.
So I don't know if you heard my intro. I didn't read. I was read to. And you are not the voice on your book. And it's funny to me when, and I didn't know you before, so I didn't, like, I knew it wasn't you, but I didn't know your voice, so it didn't really make a difference to me. But there is something, have you listened to it? Have you listened to the audiobook?
Well, now I'm very embarrassed to say I haven't.
No. And here's why. This is why. It's only because, and this is only me. So the Jared Kushner chapter, okay? I was listening to it, and the way that it sounds is so absurd. You know, Jared Kushner is in charge of this, and Jared Kushner is there. And I imagine if I was reading it, it wouldn't sound as ridiculous. But you should at least listen to that portion. I know it wasn't meant to be funny, but it was like, you might as well said, Jared Kushner is responsible for world peace. And he's reading these things, and it's so funny. But let's talk about Jared Kushner, because nobody really talks about him, and yet he was responsible for so many things.
Yep.
And I didn't even know over time that that was the case. And
well,
go
ahead. No, I was just going to say, it kind of is supposed to sound absurd.
Okay.
When you read through the list of everything that Jared Kushner was in charge of during the Trump administration, world peace was on the list. It's certainly Middle East peace and the border issues and ending the opioid crisis. The list is incredibly long. And so you have to ask yourself, well, where does this start? Well, the answer is very simple. Donald Trump is a deeply damaged man. He's a mess of a human being. And we don't talk about that enough. This is a pathetic individual who doesn't know much about politics and doesn't trust anyone in it. And so as he kind of moved into his administration, as he was there for a little while, anybody competent, you know, jumped off board, right? They either quit or were fired very, very quickly. So as you got to the time that the pandemic hit, Trump was left with those he trusted. And the person he trusted most of all was Jared Kushner. Not because Jared Kushner had ever shown even minimal competence in anything he had ever done. In fact, the reality of Jared Kushner is everything he has ever touched has been broken, right? He's literally the kind of person that if you handed him a vase and said, you know, hey, hold this for a second, he would return to you, you know, a pile of glass, right? Crushed and broken. It's just his nature. He's not good at anything. And yet Trump trusted him. And usually that doesn't mean a lot because, you know, when you put him in charge of Middle East peace is hard to accomplish anyway. He didn't do anything useful. Time passed and then you're on to the next thing. But when you put him in charge of the supply chain for a pandemic, that's kind of a serious issue. And that's what happened with Jared Kushner. In March and April of 2020, when the pandemic hit hard, when we were literally seeing people dying in incredible numbers, images appeared in the newspapers in New York, especially of nurses who were using garbage bags to protect themselves because they didn't have protective gear. Now, this was becoming a real embarrassment to the Trump administration. And so Donald Trump had to, quote unquote, do something. And when he has to do something, he calls in Jared Kushner and put Jared in charge of something that was called Project Airbridge. And Project Airbridge is everything that was wrong, not just about the Trump administration, but about American governance in general. Because instead of saying, look, we have the Defense Production Act, we have the ability to say that shuttered factories should be opened, that existing factories should shift their production to exactly what Franklin Roosevelt said during World War II, start making the protective gear. That would have been the logical response. Or if you have to import it, to say the government of the United States is going to import it. Instead, Jared Kushner, consulting with his college roommate, came up with the idea that they would take hundreds of millions of tax dollars, use U.S. Transportation vehicles and equipment, and give it over to multinational corporations, which would then import the protective gear and the healthcare materials And then when they got these things to the U.S., they weren't told what to do with them. So as a result, they sold them to the highest bidder. End result was Jared Kushner screwed up the entire supply chain for getting protective gear to people in the midst of the pandemic. End result is after about 2 months, he was shuffled out of this. They stopped. They grounded Project AirBridge. But we can trace damage to the supply chain that exists to this day back to having Jared Kushner in charge of it at that critical moment.
And then that to me segues into another one of the cast of these characters. Like a lot of them were obvious, you know, like that were like more front and center that you knew, but the Rahm Emanuel connection was really interesting to me. I mean, obviously I've never been a fan, not my kind of guy, but I don't think people realize, and this was when COVID first happened in the beginning, like to me, it was glaringly obvious that our reaction was definitely hindered from past however many years of legislation. It isn't just, oh, this current administration was a failure. It was. But there was like other stuff. And explain the Rahm Emanuel connection, especially coming from talking about Jared Kushner and the supply chain and having to go get things, you know, from afar.
You're very smart. You'd be useful in a place like Congress.
Nice endorsement right there.
But this is... You are making the connection exactly right. And one of the things I tried to do in the book, there's a lot of things I tried to do in the book, but one of the things that I thought was important was to understand not just the people that were to blame for doing tremendous damage in the moment, but to understand the systems and the structures that made it possible for them to do so much damage and to do so much harm, to actually create a circumstance where hundreds of thousands of people died that did not need to die. And if we see it in that perspective, then on something like the supply chain, you have to go back to that question of why don't we make things here? I mean, why don't we plan for emergencies? Well, of course, those are two of the critical kind of driving forces of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism doesn't like planning because if you plan for things as a government, then you're going to say, well, we have to have this sort of production. We have to invest in this sort of stuff. They never like that. They like to leave it to the market. And Rahm Emanuel was the king neoliberal of the 1990s, the 2000s, and the 2010s. And he's one of these people who invariably inserts himself into every Democratic administration. He's done that going back to the start of Bill Clinton's presidency. And once he gets in there, what he does is to advocate for free trade policies that are incredibly good for multinational corporations and investors, but that are incredibly bad for workers, not just in the United States, but in the countries we trade with. And that's what he did. He was a driving force for NAFTA. He was a driving force for the GATT agreement. He was driving force for most favored nation trading status for China, policy after policy after policy through not just the Clinton administration, but also the Obama administration. End result was that by the time Rahm Emanuel got done, long before Donald Trump showed up in the White House, we had offshored not just jobs and factories, but whole industries. When I was doing the research on the book, I talked a lot to Sherrod Brown, the senator from Ohio. Mm-hmm. And this was early on in like, you know, the spring of 2020. And Sherrod Brown said, look, you know, our problem is clear. I mean, in addition to all the other challenges, we don't make things here anymore. And we're not even in a position where we know how to get the production ramped up quickly because we did no planning. We threw that all aside. And then you ask yourself, well, who is responsible for this? Well, we can point a lot of fingers of blame. That's easy to do. But at the end of the day, when you have someone as smart as Rahm Emanuel, and he's very, very smart, and someone as politically connected as him, who is in administration after administration advocating for these free trade policies, I think he's the person that you have to point a finger of blame at and say that his responsibility parallels that of members of the Trump administration, of profiteering billionaires, of pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah. I mean, the profiteering from the big pharma, that was the obvious one, right? Like that's the one that most pedestrians would recognize. We're being ripped off for our medication. But the overall way that they bill us twice for the same thing has always been extremely frustrating to me. So we pay for R&D. We pay for all of those things to be done, but then they are the only ones to get the profits. And then we have no government to protect us from being basically raped by them. Is that,
this was on steroids during the pandemic. Because it's one of the things, like, I don't claim to be a great expert in pharmaceuticals. You know, high school, everybody tries them, but you know, or in, as we grow up, you know, yeah, I mean, I look at it, you know, it with, I think the eyes of perhaps, you know, probably a layman, except that I do cover capitalism. And when you're talking about capitalism intersecting with the pharmaceutical companies, then you end up with a pretty ugly circumstance. Now, here's the interesting thing. Pharmaceutical companies don't like to make vaccines. That doesn't excite them. They like to make drugs that you have to take every day for the rest of your life. Right? That's a good drug, right? But a vaccine, if it's effective, you get it once. Maybe you get it twice. Maybe you get a booster. But it doesn't have that long-term, you know, benefit. So for a variety of reasons, people in government knew that. When the pharmaceutical companies came into this process, they were given incredible incentives. Yes, the research was done through an incredible and amazing global cooperation, solidarity on a level that's rare in the history of the planet. People sharing DNA, people sharing breakthroughs, scientists, governments, international agencies, all trying to get here. The pharmaceutical companies who have the productive capacity step in and they say, yeah, we'll take all your research. We'll take all this stuff and we'll tinker a little with it and come up with some technologies. Pfizer, you know, really didn't do that good, to be honest. They came up with a vaccine that you had to freeze to 85 degrees below zero, right? You know, I mean, their initial quote-unquote breakthrough was obviously an emergency, tough circumstance, but they did get there. And then what they did was fascinating. They said, well, we want long-term contracts, and we're not going to opt in to the regulation on the prices. We're going to set our prices. We've got the drug first. You're going to give us these contracts for huge amounts of money, and then we're going to have riders in them that allow us to extend them. And at the end of it, these pharmaceutical companies created a situation where they were able to, A, benefit off the research, B, benefit off long-term contracts and you know, to sell the vaccines, and end result, huge profits. The profits are almost jaw-dropping. Oxfam estimates that Pfizer has been making $1 million an hour, every hour, 24 hours a day, day after day after day. Other groups that have looked at you know, a group of the pharmaceutical companies, Pfizer, Moderna, and BioNTech, will tell you that through some of the most intense moments of the pandemic, they were making $1,000 a second, $65,000 a minute, $93 million a day in revenues. This is just astronomical amounts of money. And yet when people came to them and said, look, could we you know, maybe share some of this technology? We helped you to get here. Could you, you know, give us a little bit back here? Can we help the most vulnerable people in the world? Their reaction was, are you kidding? Of course not. And they have stood in the way of you know, pharmaceutical equity. And the problem with this is a global pandemic. And if you don't have equity for other countries around the world, quickly, early on, with a huge amount of resources and a lot of flexibility, you're going to end up in a situation where you're going to have variants, right? And it's going to come back and keep haunting you. The disease will not be beaten as quickly as it could be. And so here you have pharmaceutical companies, which did play a role in fighting this pandemic. And I'll give them their credit for that. But they, because of their profiteering and because of their self-serving character, they have done harm as well. And it's really a time at which we ought to all pause and ask ourselves, you know, why do we maintain this very dysfunctional relationship? Why don't we rearrange our relationship with, but why not rearrange our relationship with Big Pharma? It isn't working at this point.
We're speaking with John Nichols of The Nation, author of Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Caused the Crisis. You know, the one thing that we have noticed regarding the vaccine mandates, and especially on the conservative side that have rejected it synonymously, you know, we talk all the time that Medicare for All is the elimination of the for-profit middlemen in between us and our doctors. I don't see how a message like that wouldn't resonate in the more conservative communities today. Because if you're even talking to, because again, the thing about Wisconsin, as you know, is it's a very libertarian red state. And so there is this belief that the government can't do anything right. Well, my argument is it's not government-run healthcare we're advocating for. It's government-funded healthcare, where the healthcare works for us. I think that there could be a great opportunity here going forward. You know, in Florida, the only thing we ever seem to get right is our ballot initiatives. But I really think there is an opportunity here to really bridge the divide on the healthcare issue, because a lot of people are seeing over the course of this pandemic, and I really believe that the source of where the distrust on the vaccine comes into play is the for-profit motive that exists within private insurance and big pharma. Could you speak to that and what your thoughts are in terms of bridging that divide regarding universal healthcare, and how that, without question, would have mitigated a lot of the disastrous results that this pandemic ultimately resulted in?
I'm sorry, I don't have my button here to hit and go bingo, because you just nailed it. I mean, you hit on something there that I've been talking about a lot in interviews about this book. And that is, I have been talking, I've been on shows where I'll get callers who are vaccine skeptics, right? And I will say right up front, I am double vaccinated. I've got my booster. And when the next booster's coming, I'm front of the line there, elbowing people aside to get it, right? I'm all in. I'm down with the vaccines. But at the same time, I can just give you chapter and verse in the profiteering, in bad policies, bad approaches of big pharma. Now, that in itself creates a situation where there's a tremendous vulnerability, because people are distrustful of a healthcare system that intersects with profit. And when you can point to such a high level of profiteering, it becomes very, very easy for people to say, well, are you sure we need these things? And we've seen a lot of that occur. And so you're exactly right. And we extend beyond the pharmaceutical companies to talk to the healthcare system, about the healthcare system in general. The truth of the matter is, if we had a single payer Medicare for All healthcare system in the United States, there is simply no doubt in my mind that hundreds of thousands of people would have lived, who in this case ended up dying. Millions of people would not have been infected, who did become infected, and tens of millions of people who suffered economic hardship and dislocation and difficulty as a result of this pandemic would have been in a much more stable place. And so I think that the pandemic showed so many of the vulnerabilities of our society. And one of the deepest vulnerabilities is that we don't have that single payer Medicare for All system. If we did, I think you're right, the skepticism would be far less. We would have a lot more people alive today, healthy today, in a functional place. And the one thing I always add to this too is that you do need a social welfare state as well. And the truth is that when I looked at countries around the world, and I interviewed leaders from countries around the world in working on the book, and you know what we came back to again and again is that countries that had a well-developed national healthcare system and a well-developed social welfare system were able to take a lot of the hits of this pandemic in that immediate moment, in that most difficult moment. And they also had the trust of their people. And experts will tell you, medical experts, ethics experts, all across the board will tell you, the most important thing in responding to this pandemic was trust in the government. Now, I'm not telling you that we should trust the government on everything. I've been critical of more governments in more situations than I could even count up. But what they're talking about is, in a situation of a crisis like this, an overwhelming moment, if the government says, look, you're going to need to wear a mask, or you're going to need to socially distance, or you're going to need to lock down, or you're going to need to get a vaccine, people are saying, yeah, I rely on this healthcare system. I trust the single payer system that we've got. I rely on this social welfare system. It does deliver. It does the things that we need. If they say this is necessary, yeah, I believe it. And in Germany, as a classic example, a country with which the United States would often want to compare itself, Germany, if you look at the level of death, in the overall population compared to the United States, it's minuscule. And in countries around the world, we just had a dramatically higher level of death as a result of this pandemic than other countries did. And when The Lancet did its study on the differences between the countries, what they determined was that in the first year of the pandemic, 40% of the deaths that occurred in the United States were unnecessary. Now, underline that, put a circle around that. Remember that 40% of the deaths, when we were talking in the range of 400, 500,000 deaths, what that means is we're moving into the hundreds of thousands of people who died unnecessarily. And I think you can trace an immense amount of that to our lack of a strong national healthcare system, to our lack of a social welfare system, and frankly, to our lack of a government that we can trust.
Yeah, it's a problem. And we don't trust them. Nope. I mean, yeah, and we shouldn't. But yeah, this was one of those times where it would behoove us to actually live somewhere where we knew our government cared enough about us to give us healthcare. See, that right there is all you need to know, is that we don't prioritize caring for the collective, and our government doesn't prioritize our healthcare. So even if they lie about a bazillion other things, we don't even trust our government on a vaccine.
And we've been very and we've also been very adamant about the fact that within the purview of the executive branch, President Biden could declare a national health emergency and expand Medicare to everybody in lieu of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. People, and again, as you know, there's usually only two types of responses. It's that's BS, and well, it'll never work. And to me, it's like we've been trained to believe that we're not entitled to anything in this country. Like that's should just be grateful for whatever crumbs we receive, and let's not put too much pressure on elected officials. My goodness, it really is supposed to be the opposite. We spend so much time fighting amongst ourselves. We need to be pointing it in the direction where it belongs, not amongst each other. Once we unite as a people, that's when everything will change. But I really think right now, do you get the sense that there is sort of this collective uprising that's happening, that despite the fact that things have been obviously very dire in many ways, I think there's a lot of grassroots energy that's happening, especially amongst the labor movement. How do you see it right now?
Oh, I totally agree. And frankly, there has to be. I write about this a lot in the book, because one of the things that was clear was that when this pandemic hit, the government, the people that were in charge of government and in charge particularly of the regulatory agencies, were not going to save people. And remember that one of the chapters in the book, one of the longest chapters in the book, is on Elaine Chao, the Secretary of Transportation. Yeah. And you're thinking like, why? Who's going to devote a chapter of any book ever to Elaine Chao? Well, the reason is that she was begged throughout the pandemic to issue a national mask mandate for public transportation. I mean, it's logical, right? You're getting on buses and planes, and the unions asked her to do it. The consumers asked her to do it. Everybody asked. She wouldn't do it. And then we had a Secretary of Labor, Scalia. Interesting that it's a Scalia running the Labor Department. And and you know, there were so many things that he could have done to make workplaces more safe, but he didn't do it, right? So the government agencies that should have been in the forefront of doing something didn't act, right? And then you ask, okay, well then luckily your benevolent employers will certainly take care of you. No, employers were literally firing whistleblowers. If somebody said people are getting sick at the Amazon warehouse or in the meatpacking plant, they were fighting to keep unions out, the whole bit, right? And so you end up in the situation where what the pandemic revealed is that people desperately need not just unions, but very, very strong unions. They need union representation that is able to confront corporate and political power on behalf of working class people. And the simple fact of the matter is that if we had the level of unionization that we had in the 1950s in this country, or that some countries still have, we would have had far fewer deaths. It's as simple as that, because you would have had people in place who could have advocated on behalf of those workers and said that if the workers weren't protected, then we're pulling people out of here. We're going to strike. And what we should have understood and what we should understand coming out of this is, of course, the pandemic gives us a lesson on why we need a national healthcare system. Of course, the pandemic gives us a lesson on why we need a social welfare state. But there's a good argument to be made that the most powerful lesson of all is that we need a strong union, no matter where you're working, because even where people had union representation, we have beaten up unions so much in this country, we have undermined and weakened them so much that even where unions did advocate in good and effective ways, they were undermined, they were weakened to such an extent that they weren't always able to do what they needed to do. So again, I always make that point of we need unions, but we need very strong unions, much stronger than I think most Americans fully understand. If we had it, I do think that things would be better. And to your point, I think that is why people across this country, especially frontline workers, are organizing and they are striking and they're pushing back. And I think that part of the reason is that power did something it rarely does. Briefly, just for a moment, it told the working class that it was essential. And when you tell the working class that it's essential, working class people might start to think, well, if I'm essential, maybe you should pay me a living wage. Maybe you should actually try to protect me rather than just send me into battle without a mask.
I think that is an excellent point, John. And of course, I'm speaking with John Nichols of The Nation. You know, one of the problems that we have here in Florida, not just because the union leadership is very archaic, the head of the county AFL-CIO, where Jen ran against Wasserman Schultz, was probably her biggest line of defense, we would say, and a lot of the smaller unions wanted to support, but they all fall under the same hub. But the reason that it's such a big problem in the state of Florida is the same reason that the labor movement has been so devastated in the state of Wisconsin. That, of course, is the right to work laws. Now, this is one of the reasons why we're advocates for the PRO Act. It's the one piece of federal legislation that really has a good amount in it, specifically alleviating the issues of the right to work laws. When it comes to fighting for these issues at the federal level, it seems like we're kind of in a no-win situation because nothing is getting through. It really is a catastrophe at this point in terms of how bad it is. So my question to you, what is your opinion about pushing for these statewide initiatives? You know, again, ballot initiatives down here in Florida seem to be the only way that we really get anything done regarding healthcare, regarding anything else. It seems that fighting at the state level might be a path, it's not the only path, but it might be a better path. What are your thoughts on that relating to where the labor movement is now regarding the issues of right to work laws? And how do we move forward dealing with these major issues we want to get past if it in fact has to be done at the state level?
Well, it does have to be done a lot of times at the state level because the federal government is such a mess. And the federal government's a mess because of money and politics. I mean, that's something that we should always emphasize. It's hard at the state level as well. If you try to overturn right to work in Florida, you're going to have a lot of very wealthy people that are going to try and stop you. That's a given.
Yeah.
Not all states even have Florida's wonderful initiative process, right? You know, my state of Wisconsin doesn't allow initiatives. And so if you've got them, use them. There's simply no doubt of that. But let me also offer another notion. I've covered politics for a very long time. And my advice to people when they're trying to do things is do popular stuff, right? I mean, do things that people are actually going to like, because then you can actually win for something that even if power spends a lot of money to stop you, you can prevail. And so seize the moment. It happens right now. Unions are super popular. Unions are polling better than at any time since the 1960s, way above where it was 10, 15 years ago. So if ever there was a time to do it, the intersection of what we learned from the pandemic, as well as the fact that unions are just genuinely popular, this is a great time to do exactly what we're thinking of. But when I talk about doing popular stuff, if I can, just extend it out a little bit and say, this is the problem with the Biden administration right now. They don't do enough popular stuff. And in the book, I talk about billionaires a lot. And I'm not as nice to them as I probably should be. At the start of the pandemic, there were 614 billionaires in the United States, right? 18 months later, there were 745 of them. That was one of the most exponential increases in the number of billionaires in history. That happened really, really fast. And you're saying to yourself, that's odd. I thought, you know, we were in this very difficult time. How did a whole bunch of people get a whole bunch richer? And then you realize, well, it isn't just that you know, you got these newcomer billionaires. The old billionaires got a lot richer too. In fact, the amount of money in the United States controlled by billionaires at the start of the pandemic was $3 trillion. The amount of money controlled by billionaires 18 months into the pandemic was $5 trillion. That was a level of growth. I mean, no stock market grows that fast. Nothing grows that fast except billionaire wealth. We distributed wealth upwards during the pandemic. We have distributed upwards at a rate that is unprecedented in history. And so when I talk about doing popular stuff, I think this would be a really, really good time to propose a great big whomping tax on billionaires. And I'm not talking about your kind of like nice, kind of gentle tax. I'm talking about a Franklin Delano Roosevelt level of taxation. During World War II, the top marginal tax rate was 95%. Now it went down. They did bring it down a little because they wanted to moderate. They did take it down to 92% in the later stages and then into the Eisenhower presidency. But understand this. Why did they go to 95%? What Roosevelt and even Republicans in Congress said at that time was, look, we're in a terrible situation. This is a really demanding time. And so you can't profiteer at some sort of obscene level now. In fact, we're asking everyone to share in the sacrifice. And so if we're asking everyone to share in the sacrifice of the billionaire class has to be that they don't exponentially increase their wealth. And if by some chance, certainly a mistake, that you go from being an ordinary billionaire to an uber billionaire, we're going to assist you by taxing you back into your ordinary billionaire status. And so with a 95% tax rate, which again, would just be doing what we did during World War II, or even a 92%, which is what we did in the aftermath of World War II, we would be able to get $2 trillion right now. And remember, this isn't making people not billionaires anymore. That's another issue altogether. This isn't a wealth tax. This is literally a tax on what they've been taking in during the pandemic. And to just say, we're going to take you back to where you were at the start of it. You're just going to be obscenely rich, not jaw-droppingly obscenely rich. And by the way, I would also do this with the pharmaceutical companies, because the pharmaceutical companies, as we noted before, posted exceptional profits. Well, during World War II, under Roosevelt, we said that a company could be taxed up to 90% on its profits. And that was, but they did it very reasonably. They said that's on profits that are above what you used to make before the war. So they're basically saying, we're only going to ding you if you are profiteering off this emergency situation. Now, what that would mean with Pfizer and Moderna and some of these other companies is that we would just, you know, we would tax them down back to where they were at. But they wouldn't have doubling of their revenues. They wouldn't have doubling of their profits. And the fact of the matter is, I know people are going to say to me, well, that's really dangerous. That's extreme. That's going too far. No, that's American. That's what we did. That's what we have done in the past during very, very difficult times. And also, I've pitched this idea. Last night, I spoke to a group of nuns, and they all loved it. In fact, I haven't encountered anybody that didn't like this idea of taxing the billionaires. So if I could use your platform to give a little advice to President Biden, you know, look, Mr. President, your approval rating's not that high right now. Why not do something really popular? Why not say, hey, we found the money for Build Back Better. We're going to tax the super rich, and we're going to tax them back down to where they were before the pandemic. I'm going to tell you something. If that's all Biden talked about for the next 6 months, Democrats would do great in the midterms. Yeah. So doing popular stuff is, and I say that to Floridians on labor issues. I say that at the national level, doing popular stuff works. And it always boggles my mind that Democrats can't seem to figure that out.
I just think they don't care. I think that they just are suckling from the same teat, and they just don't want their little gravy train to end. That's what I think. And they all like it. And I think they liked having Trump in the White House. They got to pose MIC resistance. They got to pretend. I think Nancy Pelosi had her greatest fundraising ever while Trump was in the White House. And I think they love that, you know, but
great example of that would be John, you know who Lynn Wood is, right? From Trump's attorney team. Well, he just gave a max donation to Nikki Fried, who is supposed to be the favorite frontrunner of the Democratic Party here in Florida for governor against Ron DeSantis. So they all swim in the same pool.
Yes.
And the sooner you realize that, unless you're not part of that corporate infrastructure, like the Senate of Vermont, you know, that's really where the change will happen, is following Bernie's lead and recognizing that we have to elect non-corporate representation. And that is really the big difference here. I know it takes time, but I kind of feel like even this next election, not 22, but, you know, potentially in 24, I get this sense that people are starting to figure out this game. You know, there was a political awakening for a lot of people in this whole Bernie Trump phenomenon that we're not fully aware. I mean, you've been in it for a long time. You have seen these trends, whereas a lot of people don't know these trends. They don't know FDR swinging through JFK, then coming back through to Reagan, and then everything shooting down, and things that Clinton did and Bush did and all that. We are ripe for a generational change right now. And the question is, how is that going to unfold? Jen, if there's anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to talk a little bit about accountability, because that's something that we didn't really talk about. I mean, and the conclusion is called the United States of Impunity. I do appreciate all the quotes at the beginning of the chapters, by the way. There's a lot of Thomas Paine.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but that's really what I feel like we constantly see. And for this administration, for Trump's administration, everyone thinks, oh, you know, this time they're going to go after him. They're going to prosecute him. Mm-hmm. And yet, to me, all I've seen in my life is every administration forgives the previous administration because they don't want the next administration to prosecute them. And we just keep doing this over and over and over again, because I would say arguably Obama could have tried the entire W administration for war crimes and had,
crashing the global economy.
Right. So how do we get any accountability? Is there ever going to be accountability for this coronavirus? Yes. Based on some of it was natural, some of it, I mean, obviously, you know, you're not going to say that, you know, it was intentional, you know, it's not like a war, but there, how do we get any accountability for this?
So first off, Jen, you summed it up perfectly, because it was a global pandemic. It was something that in some ways couldn't be controlled. So you don't seek accountability for the fact that it occurred. You seek accountability for the fact that it was worse than it had to be. And that's the subtle distinction that we make. You say, okay, you're handed a very, very difficult situation. Do you make it better or do you make it worse? And then, so that's the first thing. The second question is, if you make it worse, do you do so because you're a scorching incompetent who shouldn't ever be allowed near power? Or do you do so deliberately because you are seeking political advantage or economic advantage? And what I write about in the book, every chapter in the book, is somebody who I argue deliberately acted in ways that damaged us as a country and caused death and disease and horror. And when I say deliberately, I think there are those who will say, oh, well, you're trying to suggest they were plotting, you know. No. They were actually operating quite openly within the system as it operates today. And that is that if you are the president of the United States and you're handed a difficult situation, the minute it occurs, instead of saying, oh my gosh, how are we going to help the people? Your political advisors are in there saying, well, here's how we can take advantage of this. And here's how we can come out ahead. And Donald Trump, as in so many cases, actually revealed that thinking in real time, because he met with Bob Woodward and said, yeah, it's a slight variation on his words here, but essentially, I'm lying to the American people because I believe my best tool for getting reelected is a strong economy. And so I want to downplay this pandemic so we can get back to work as quickly as possible. And that will help me get reelected. That was Donald Trump's thinking. And as a result, he made a bad situation dramatically worse. That is something that demands accountability. The same is true for a CEO that fires whistleblowers who are saying that people are sick in the plant, for someone who fails to provide the protections. you know, you just keep running down the line. If you can find deliberate actions that seek to make political advantage or seek to make economic advantage, that's where we start to talk about accountability. And then very quickly, when we talk about accountability, it can take many, many forms. I don't happen to be all that into punishment. I know. And boy, I like when I was talking to the nuns last night, there were quite a few who sort of liked the idea of punishment. But then I'd remind them of forgiveness and everything sort of all sorted out. No, I think accountability is done primarily not in the individual circumstance, but to drive change. And if we hold people to account, we create a situation where the society recognizes, A, we can never have those people in power again. B, we've got to set up structures that are different. Has this happened in history? Has it ever happened in history? The answer is yes. Under Roosevelt in the early 1930s, in the midst of the Great Depression, which again, like a pandemic, was treated as something that just happened. It was a global depression. What could we possibly do? They brought in a mob prosecutor, a guy who prosecuted mobsters, Ferdinand Percora, and they put him in charge of doing investigations for a Senate committee. And he did not pull any punches. He did the research, and then he called bankers. He called CEOs before that committee, and he grilled them. And they didn't have the answers. And so as a result of the Percora Commission investigations, people were charged with crimes. People were fined massive amounts of money. People were removed from their positions. And we passed the banking regulations of the 1930s. They were one of the biggest crackdowns on corruption on Wall Street and in business in the history of this country. And so that's what I'm talking about. I believe that when we talk about accountability for the coronavirus pandemic, we should leave nothing off the table. Criminal, civil, and congressional action is entirely appropriate and necessary. Donald Trump shouldn't have just been impeached for January 6th. He should have been impeached for his lies about the pandemic and those lies having caused hundreds of thousands of people to die unnecessarily. And then if we go beyond that, if we're saying, yes, we can use impeachment for such a purpose, and it's absurd that we didn't, we can also say that there continue to be avenues for accountability now. And the truest and easiest accountability of all is to tax the profiteers at a 95% rate and to tax excess profits for pharmaceutical companies and other companies at a level that makes them know that they can never do this again. Now, I know all of this sounds like, you know, great dreams and, you know, visions of things that we could or should do. A, I will emphasize we've done it in the past during the Great Depression, during World War II. And B, I will emphasize to you that if we don't do it now, if we look away and say this is impossible, then I promise you we will have another pandemic or another crisis, and we will have worse people in charge, and they will do us more damage. So if we care about our future, we should embrace accountability now as not just our birthright, but also our moral duty.
This has been one of the most insightful interviews we have done since starting this podcast about 15 months ago. John, you are...
He is Dr. Evil. This is... Dr. Evil on the cover.
Yes, and I wish people would understand the... As dangerous as Trump is, the danger of people like Bezos in charge is even greater.
He's like Lord. Have you seen Shrek?
Oh yeah. Okay. I've got kids. Yeah. All
right. Okay. Jeff Bezos is Lord Farquaad. Like, to me, it is like I could almost picture him being lifted off his horse with the fake legs. Like, you know, they had to put the fake legs on him to make him seem taller than he was. Like, that's how I think of him. Like, Jeff Bezos to me is a very small man.
You're such a gentle person, though. look, I got to tell you, none of us, and I read a lot of fiction and read a lot of literature. You can't create, nobody's had the imagination yet to create someone who in the midst of a pandemic would, you know, exponentially increase their wealth, fire the whistleblowers at their warehouses, block a union, and then use the money to fly into outer space.
And a big penis.
Yeah, I mean, with all due respect, and to try to take William Shatner along, you know, I mean, you just, it's beyond, you could not make this up. And then if you have an intersection with Elon Musk, who's trying to get up there faster, and one of the things I write about in the book, and I know we're getting done here, but I'll just leave you with this little tidbit of, you know, kind of joyous factuality, that in the midst of a pandemic where we were asking nurses to risk their lives to save us, when we were asking bus drivers to drive people in the middle of the night to hospitals, you know, knowing that sick people were getting on their buses, when we were asking immigrants to go into meatpacking plants and, you know, produce our food, even though they didn't have adequate protection, and when so many of these people died, in the midst of this pandemic, for the first time, we had open speculation about who would be the first trillionaire. And whether it would be Bezos or whether it would be Musk. And the fact is, just take those simple facts and put them together, it ought to lead us all to be angry enough to demand, you know, not just accountability, but fundamental change, a real political revolution, because we're off the rails. We are in the most absurd moment, I think, in history. And when you've got billionaires flying off into outer space, I believe in a simple 95% tax, but another tax that we could establish would be a reentry fee. And we let them take off, but if they want to come back, they're going to have to pay us, I don't know, a couple trillion.
It's absurd to me. I don't understand. I mean, obviously these are psychopathic people. Like, the thought to me that I have the ability to end homelessness or world hunger, and yet I choose not to do that, that to me is a psychopath. Like, I can't, it's beyond comprehension. But I obviously do not like these people, but I don't have a problem with billionaires. My problem is you can't get that way without screwing your workers, screwing the environment, and not paying your taxes. If you showed me billionaires whose workers could work a 40-hour work week, live a life of dignity, had health care, had all these things, it might not bother me so much. And so it really isn't how rich the rich are for me. It's how poor the poor are. And I just think that they only get that way from cheating. See, that's the problem. They're not getting it legitimately. They're getting it. It's legal. It's legal, but it's not.
It's only legal because they've bought made it legal.
Right,
because
right.
They bought a system that allowed them to say it was legal. And you know what?
We are going. Could we possibly get you to come back only next time? I would like to have you come back with Harvey Kay.
And
we really need to do a crash course, because I really think Wisconsin, in many ways, is the embodiment of the best of what this country can be, and what it became the worst of what this country can be.
So we're still going to be the best again, by the way.
Well, you know,
we're fighting our fights.
Are you a teacher?
I'm a journalist.
No, I know you're a journalist, but do you teach classes?
You know, occasionally I'll do a lecture here or there or something like that. But no, I mean, I went into journalism for the same reason that any reasonable person did. It's the only profession that allows you to pick on the powerful, and, you know, like, throw spitballs from the back of the class for the rest of your life. And teaching has certain responsibilities that Harvey's embraced, and I certainly respect him for that. But look, the bottom line on this is that what you both of you just brought up is, it's a great place. I know we're kind of winding out here, but what both of you brought up was a really important thing. And I'll give you a simple, quick story. I live in a neighborhood with a lot of family-owned, you know, small businesses, and one of them, the best of them, is the Cork and Bottle Liquor Store. And I was in there when the global economy crashed, right? And because of bad government policies and because of, you know, what banks and other people were doing, and things were being revealed about, you know, the practices of these big banks and stuff. And Connie, one of the women who owned the liquor store, was saying to me, you know, it's funny, I get up early and I come to work and I work 9, 10, 11 hours, 12 hours a day. And I've been watching these last few years where all these people get really, really rich. And I thought, you know what? They must just be smarter than me or work harder than me or something. I really was thinking that. It was kind of getting me down. But I sort of am like this, you know, economic meltdown, because what it's revealing is that they're just crooks, you know, and that's a fundamental revelation when we realize that the super rich are just crooks, right? They're people that got rich, not because they worked hard or because they were smarter, but they were willing to cut corners in ways that were fundamentally more dangerous than most Americans would. Then it becomes a lot easier to hold them to account. And if we realize that they do that, they continue their crooked behaviors in a pandemic, you know, at a moment when you know, you think, like, even in bad movies, right? You know, it's in a moment like that that the villain says, "Oh my gosh, I realize the error of my ways. I've got to help you, you know, to deal with this situation." No, our villains don't do that. Our villains say, "Wow, it's a pandemic. I can get a whole bunch richer." And so as a result, that's certainly why I wrote the book. But it's also something that I think gets to the point you were making just a moment ago, that there is a churn out there. There are movements rising. There are people who are passionate for change. They are running for office across the country in difficult uphill races, Jen. And they don't always win, but they put these issues out there. And I think they're doing it because they love their country and they love the prospect of the future. And boy, I'm going to cheer on.
Good. Well, we'll come and seek your endorsement in a couple of years.
Yeah, it is. Coronavirus criminals and pandemic profiteers. Accountability for those who caused the crisis. John Nichols of The Nation.
Thank you so much.
One of the best. And thank you so much. We hope to have you again soon, my friend.
You'll come back, right? You'll come back sometime.
Of course. I'm honored to be with both of you. It's been fun.
Thank you
for what you do. Appreciate it, brother. Take care. So needless to say, yes, but this, and again, I didn't want to get into it, but it's like, this is what a real journalist is. This whole idea of what journalism is today, it's not what it used to be.
Yeah, thank you.
And so having just a very insightful conversation and understanding exactly what raw power, when wielded by the wrong people, will do.
Well, and it's a perfect storm of things. That's the thing. Like, that was what was cool about this book, is that each chapter in and of itself is horrifying. And then the fact that all of these things were simultaneously occurring made for this perfect storm. And all of these people are extremely culpable. He's right. These people are all criminal people. Like, this is
ridiculous. Didn't get a chance to talk about Governor Cuomo.
No, because it was actually not that big of a chapter, because that was really kind of specific to there. But
I didn't do as bad as you people want to think that I did.
I wanted to talk, like, this also brought up for me thoughts of, you know, growing up in Florida and what it's like post-hurricane. And there's rules against price gouging. Like, that's a thing. There's actually rules against that. People can actually get in trouble for that. So I remember after Hurricane Andrew, there were a lot of people that were actually getting in trouble for gouging for water and ice and different things. And yet we don't seem to have a problem when a handful of people basically gouge the entire planet.
Well, society has fallen apart in many ways. And we've seen that. This is not a new thing.
We idolize the rich. That, to me, is the biggest thing. It's like, we don't go after them because we hope to be them.
Well, I still think the best part.
And by we, I don't mean me.
Yes. Well, I still think the best part, and hats off to David Sirota, got nominated for an Oscar for Don't Look Up.
Woo! Guys, if you haven't seen it, you got to see Don't Look Up.
You know, the message of Don't Look Up, which I thought was so certainly the most important, is the fact that him and Adam McKay built a composite of Musk, Bezos, Zuckerberg.
I actually think it's mostly Gates.
It is mostly Gates.
I think it's
a compilation of them, but it is Gates. There's no question that that's who their primary focus is. And the way that they portrayed him as the psychopathic, out of control narcissist that they are, and the way that the people, rather than rejecting the rich outright. Remember, there was a time in this country that people saw the rich for being against the people. Today, the penis envy for rich people is nuts.
You said penis.
But it's true. It's this idea that, oh, they're benevolent. They must, as John Nichols said, they must be the smart ones.
I assure you not.
The ones who figure, no, they're not. They're not at all.
No, but they do have that dark triad of personality traits that we did discuss. If you guys haven't seen that episode, that was another discussion I really liked with Brian Klass. And it was about that book, Corruptible. And it has to do with the kind of people that get into these power positions. And they do tend to exhibit the dark triad, which is narcissism, Machiavellianism, and psychopathy. And these people are that. I can't fathom thinking that I could end world hunger and then going to sleep and not doing that. Like, that it's bizarre. And then we revere these people. We revere them. They should be incarcerated. Jeff Bezos is disgusting. He's a very small man. I assure you, these people do not work harder than anybody else. I also can give a shout out to the show Succession, if you guys haven't watched. Highly recommend. When we're talking about the rich and powerful, I do think you're right. It's basically like based on Rupert Murdoch's family or whatever. But like, the concept, these people have no concept.
Hank, what we will tell you is that we do support the third party movement.
We do.
But the reality is you need ranked choice voting. You need to deal with first past the post voting, which is a huge part of the
issue. Oh, I was thinking
issue.
That during when Chris was on about if he had ranked choice voting in Dallas, that would be amazing.
You don't have that. You don't have a financial infrastructure.
You wouldn't need runoffs if you had ranked choice voting.
No. And you also need people running, quite frankly, if we're being honest here, you need people running in nonpartisan races. That's what you really need. That's a big part of the equation because then it doesn't matter what party you're in. It just matters that you're not bought by corporate special interests. And that could be done in city commission races, county commission races, mayoral races. There are a lot of things that can be done to mitigate this issue. And so we do support third parties as needed. Again,
it's sort of like, feel like you got to throw enough shit against the wall, something's going to stick. You have to be doing all of it. But we do not have that in this state. We have closed primaries. We do not have third parties of any substance here. And if you do not participate within the major parties, you don't participate.
We also have five states that currently have some form of a voting system that is more advantageous to what we currently have. State of Maine and the state of Alaska have ranked choice voting. So there would be two places where if you are concerned about building a third-party infrastructure, you need to be planting your flag there. That's where you need to do it. California, Washington, and Louisiana have jungle primaries.
That's not the same thing.
Not the same thing, but at least it gives you additional options, especially regarding corporate candidates versus non-corporate.
Okay, while everybody's on here, or there's a certain amount of people on here, guys, if anybody knows anybody who lives in Indian River County, I believe that's the Vero Beach area, okay? We need somebody who would like to run for the new Senate seat there. We need somebody who would like to run for the new Senate seat there. I cannot remember the number of the seat. It's in Indian River County. It's the new Florida Senate seat. Guys, somebody needs to step up and run for the seat, preferably as an independent in the general, because my understanding is that this is a red district. And so we need somebody who can actually win.
If there is an opportunity, we think that the one party right now that has an opportunity to build some type of a electoral infrastructure is the Forward Party. And if that is true, then the infrastructure, whoever, you know, would be in place to run in a district like that would have a lot more sway with voters than it would just saying, well, I'm running as a Democrat.
Yeah.
You're not going to win.
No, but guys, if you are a Democrat and you live in Indian River County and you would like to run for state Senate and you would consider changing your affiliation, running as an independent, winning, and then caucusing with the Dems, please reach out at Generational Change because we need somebody to run for that seat. There is a woman running that must be stopped. Erin Grawl, who is a state representative in Tallahassee, she is none other than the woman that we have profiled on here for pushing the parental consent for abortion laws. She is one of those evangelicals and she is running basically for this open seat. And I would like to see that not be given to her for free. Yep. I would like to see her have to fight for that seat and then preferably lose it, but at least fight for that seat.
And as we've always said, you know, the biggest problem with the Democratic Party is that they got in bed with Wall Street. The biggest problem with the Republican Party is they got in bed with the evangelicals.
It's a problem.
That's a big part of it.
This is the kind of people that we don't need. And I'm fully even saying, like, if you're conservative fiscally, you're a libertarian, you're whatever, please reach out. Maybe you could run in this against this woman. Run against her in a primary.
And libertarians, as much as anybody, believe in the separation of church and state. They are constitutional absolutists. So I would think that this would be a case where you would say, yeah, we could definitely use a different type of representative. Maybe not a Democrat, but this is the argument for changing the electoral dynamics
in
this country.
Indian River County. We need somebody to run for state Senate there. Just putting that out there in the universe. What do we have coming up?
Well, on Monday, we are going, and I think on Monday, I think what we're going to do.
Not even going to be here.
No, I'm not, but that's okay. I like the idea of a panel. I like the panel that we just did on Monday with Melanie DiRigo, Joe Sackman, and Bob Buonasquina regarding New York gerrymandering. I think since we're going to be having on Andre Stackhouse from Hull, Washington, it might be a good opportunity to have a little bit of a panel. One of the people that we could ask is Jason Call, since he is on the board of Hull, Washington. So that, to me, I think is, we are going to have Andre on, but I think we can ask him to bring on two more guests. I think that is something that we're
probably doing. Well, then, you know what we could do? We could do like a Washington thing.
Yeah, we could.
Okay. Might as well, like, you know, do that.
Maybe ask Rebecca Parsons.
That'd be fine.
So we can, we have a few people that we could ask to
really
come
like
on.
Jason Call.
Yeah, he's great. And then on Wednesday, we are going to have on Colonel Rob Manis. He is a conservative from Louisiana who ran for the U.S. Senate. He is very much in that Trump camp. But I think it's important for us to have these conversations and see where we can find common ground.
I'm not sure about this one. So it'll be very interesting to see how that goes. Like that, you know, I mean, for me, it was sort of like, I think Carol Roth is as right as I go in wanting to like converse.
This guy is definitely right.
I think that I'm going to,
But I think it's, but again, like I said,
Does he support cannabis?
You know what? I'm not sure.
See, now there is an interesting question because that's something where libertarians absolutely are, you know.
I think there's a lot of things if we just have a substantive conversation and explain our position. The biggest thing about-
Or I could just light up in front of him and see what happens.
Well, you could do that and you'll probably do that anyway, so-
I don't ever do it in front of guests unless I know they're the, like they're participant. I don't do that in front of guests. I didn't do that. I wait until they're not on.
Oh, okay.
Only when it's people that I know that are like I can light up in front of Steve
Jason
Rumbine
Call.
Or Jason Call. Yeah.
There you go.
But I'm just saying, like, I didn't do that in front. I didn't do that.
By the way, shout out to Jordan Chariton of Status Quo. Today he had Steve Grumbine and Fidel Khabib do a host panel.
I love Steve Grumbine.
He really did a great job, and Jordan really works himself to the bone. It would be nice if he doesn't have to do live streams all the time. If he can substitute with somebody like Steve, that would be great. Maybe even have us do it one time.
I would love to. When we had them on and we were talking about the media stuff, I would love for them to have like,
now that would help our channel. That would.
But if there was some way for the real journalists to get together and sort of have something, I would love to be part of it and be like, we would be the, not the real news. We'd be like, what do you call that? Not necessarily the news. You don't remember that show because that was like before your time. There was a show called Not Necessarily the News. We would be the Not Necessarily the News of the network.
And let me tell you something. John Nichols is one of the most, he is a prominent journalist. He is not just any journalist.
Yeah, no.
The guy has hundreds of thousands of followers on social media, and he follows maybe 300 people, and Jen's one of them.
Except for we know who that really is.
But at the end of the day, it really goes to show you that because of what we're doing, we have formulated great relationships with a lot of important voices. And so what if we don't have 15,000 live streamers watching us?
It would be nice though, guys. Share the love, spread the love. I've been trying to market a little bit more. And guys, if you're not patrons and you want to be a patron, put the thing up. See, you are supposed to be like a master marketer.
I'm doing
that. You're supposed to be the marketer. This is like, you know, the thing where like the shoemaker's kids don't have shoes. That's like being with him because you're a marketer, but yet you never market us. You market other people. I'm just saying. Your shoemakers.
I just want to say that I really like that John Nichols.
He's great.
He's tremendous. He's a really great guy. And I really like that coffee cake. So in Wisconsin, which has been good to me both times that I ran for president, as you guys probably remember, I won Wisconsin in 2016 in a landslide. It was a great victory.
My freshman year roommate was from Appleton, Wisconsin. I was the first Jew she ever met.
Love Appleton. Great place. Apples are great. You know?
I was the first Jew she ever met.
The first big rally that I ever did in 2016 was at the University of Wisconsin. There were 10,000 people who showed up. It was a wonderful time. And if you like the content that is being discussed here this evening, go to patreon.com.
Are you a patron?
Generational change.
Are you a patron? I don't see your name scroll across.
I can't afford to be a patron.
I
can't afford.
I still don't see your name scroll across.
No, I think this is... I really think that you're doing a great job.
We're transforming politics into service.
That is exactly why Not Me Us is a wonderful message. And that is what you need to do. You need to transform politics into service. It's a great idea. So I just,
you know what, Jacob, we've talked about TikTok, but the truth is, yeah.
Bye.
And I mean, why are we not doing TikTok? Like, I forget. Like, this is so out of my league. I think that we're just old and we're not really, I think that the kids have no shoes and you don't.
No, we need to figure out how to use it. I think that would help us.
Hey, Jacob, if you want to do TikTok, he doesn't do Steve Buscemi.
How do you do, fellow kids?
He looks like him, but he doesn't do him.
I look like Buscemi?
You kind of have, a little bit. I could see it. You have big eyes. Yes, I do. I could see it. But I'm Jacob, if you're interested, if you want to help out, you want to be our TikTok person, we are always accepting help. I think I might have landed us a new video person to help do stuff for.
We definitely need a mod for the channel. That we definitely need.
So this, I always thought that Sarah was actually how we thought was Declan, but then I don't know.
I don't know.
They just keep reinventing a new name. That's the thing. So it's like
got a little anti-Semitic this evening.
What did it say? She didn't like that I talked about Jews in Texas and Texas Jews, but there is a big difference. And if anybody doesn't know, I'm serious. And Jews in Texas and Texas Jews both know that there is a difference.
Yeah, we're definitely gonna have to figure out this TikTok thing because I've seen how
Jews are allowed to say Jews. That. It's just the way it is.
Oh, okay.
Just the way it is. What was going on? I don't know, but something was anti-Semitic. I didn't know what was going on.
No, it was something that lady Sarah was saying. And she had to get blocked.
Sarah with the Jewish last name, but I think it's a fake profile.
Probably. We have generally good people on here.
Like Sarah Baumgarten or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, but you know what? That's fine. I find it helps our numbers.
Blue, I'm going to assume that you were probably on the other live stream that's catching all the attention this evening, which is okay. Hopefully a lot of them will come over and check this out after the fact.
It certainly won't be because we would be mentioned on that other live stream.
Jen's not too happy with that, but that's
okay. I just think that, you know, it's like, I just think that what we try to do here is bring people up and build people up. And to me, when people don't do that, I notice that's all it is. Oh, you know what I'm doing on Saturday? On Saturday, the 19th, I'm going on with Greg Arias.
Oh, okay.
I know, but I always like talking to him. He's got like a good crew.
Jacob, this is our email, generationalchange@gmail.com. Anything that you want to provide or thoughts that you have, please send them over. We're always appreciative.
Yeah, we take help of all kinds. And also we can give credit. Like if somebody mm-hmm. was a student and wanted to get credit, we've done that. We just have no money.
I think we've got a good show. At the end of the day, we just, we can't get any traction. And there are many reasons for that. But it is what it is. We're suppressed.
We talk about stuff that is not, very appreciated by powers that be. And a lot of people that started channels after a certain point just cannot get the traction. You know,
we could just be a gossip channel and talk crap about everybody else. Maybe we'll get big that way.
I'd rather not. We can talk. I mean, look, we've got a lot of drama going on in the state right now politically. So we've got a lot of stuff going on here. Well, seriously, Indian River County, we need somebody to run for state senate.
Mallory, you are correct. There are a lot of good people that are running for office that are being interviewed right now by friends of ours. So, yes, definitely just saw the notification light. Blue, don't worry about it. It's all good. Again, just spread the word, guys. Jacob, you've been great. Really appreciate your support.
No, she's not though.
You don't know that because that person may be in other chats. So you can't assume that.
Okay.
So it is what it is. But again, Jimmy's got his people. They don't think too highly of us.
He's right. It is. We do have prestigious guests and it's stupid. But I also don't think that any of these guests are reading the chat.
Probably not.
I don't think they are. With especially some of the older people that we have on, like John Nick, they're not looking in the chat.
They just enjoy the conversation.
Yeah, no, seriously, they're not reading the chat. I don't even know that they even notice the banners across the bottom because we've on several occasions put up questions, but you really have to direct them to even look at that. And that's right on the screen. So they're mostly not, but I agree. It's embarrassing. And it's really a shame, but yet that person seems to look, they give us a lot of attention. They watch. It's funny when somebody comes on and says, "You suck. There's all these people watching someone else, but yet they're watching you." That's why it's so funny to me. It's so stupid.
Well, with that said, it's been a wonderful evening. We hope you guys have enjoyed
it. Peter's leaving town, but he didn't tell me until yesterday.
Cry harder. I will be back on Tuesday. I am going to New Jersey for a few days, friend's family wedding. And I will be live from New Jersey.
Oh, but you better bring the good light. Mallory, I was talking about that. And all I'm talking about is to spread the little love, help promote a little bit, throw us a bone here or there. That's all I'm talking about. You know what I mean? That's it.
Maybe someday.
That's all. It's not hate. It's just, throw us a bone.
We'll see you Monday, guys. Thanks again. And get to that Patreon.
Thanks for watching. If you want to support our mission to transform politics into service, please like this video, subscribe, follow us on social media, and consider joining our Patreon, where you'll get early access to our interviews as well as other exclusive content. Links are in the description. Peace out.